Good morning. It's 9 o'clock. Time for us to begin our Bible class on the book of Esther. We're studying both the book of Ezra and Esther, and we're studying them chronologically, which means we're looking at Esther in between chapter 6 and chapter 7 of Ezra. Once we get through with Esther, we'll go back to chapter 7 of Ezra. Let me remind everyone that the audio copies of these lessons, they're all available on the internet at studyezra.com, studyezra.com. Also, handouts are available there. For instance, today I'll probably refer to the handout from last week, and if you don't have that, you can pull that up at studyezra.com. This is lesson 16. We'll be starting in a moment in chapter 2 of Esther at verse 15. Let's begin our class with a prayer. Our dear Father in heaven, we're thankful for this, another beautiful day that you've given us, Father, a day in which we can all gather together and study your word and worship you. Father, it is such a blessing and a privilege to be able to do that freely, and we pray that that will continue. But Father, even if it does not, our prayer is that we will continue to be faithful to you in all circumstances. And Father, our prayers, as we study Esther, we will see the lessons you have in there for us about you and about your plan for us and about your plan for your people and about your providence and your loving care for your people. And Father, as we study that book, our prayers that we will see the examples in there that we should follow and perhaps some that we should not follow, and that we will always take our stand for you and that we will stand up and be counted and let our identity be known to all, Father. And we pray all of these things in Jesus' name. Amen. When we left Esther last week, she had just joined the harem of King Xerxes of Persia, who at this time was perhaps the most powerful man on earth, King Xerxes. So let's pick up then with chapter 2 of Esther at verse 15. Now, when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her for his daughter, was come to go in unto the king, she required nothing but what Haggai, the king's chamberlain, the keeper of the women, appointed. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all them that looked upon her. So Esther was taken unto King Ahasuerus, into his house royal in the 10th month, which is the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. And the king loved Esther above all the women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast unto all his princes and his servants, even Esther's feast. And he made a release to the provinces and gave gifts according to the state of the king. Well, we need to pause at this point and consider a very important question that we've only hinted at so far in our look at Esther. And that is Esther portrayed here as a positive example or as a negative example? Now, for many, the question itself is surprising. Is there any doubt that Esther is a positive role model? Well, yes, there is some doubt, at least by some, and they would point, for instance, to what we just read. And remember that the inspired text here has carefully concealed, and will continue to conceal, Esther's thoughts and her motivations. All we see about Esther in the book of Esther are her actions and her words. We don't know what's going on inside her head. So that's concealed from us. And quite frankly, she does seem to rise to her position of high power, her high position here in the government of Xerxes as queen. She does not seem to rise there by her consistent obedience to the law. As, for example, Joseph did. As, for example, Daniel did. Here's what one modern commentary said about Esther. And I'm not telling you I agree or disagree with this. I'm telling you what they said, and we'll talk about it. How would you use this episode from Esther's life to teach virtue to your teenage daughter? What message would she get? Make yourself as attractive as possible to powerful men. Use your body to advance God's kingdom. The end justifies the means. That's a little harsh. Did Esther initially hide her identity rather than face persecution as a child of God, as some suggest? Did she engage in situational ethics, as some argue? We know that soon she will take a very courageous stand, a very courageous stand. But is she being courageous here as well? Here's what an even harsher commentator said. This is from a 15th century Jewish commentary on the book of Esther. Now, when Mordecai heard the king's herald announcing that whoever had a daughter or a sister should bring her to the king to have intercourse with an uncircumcised heathen, why did he not risk his life to take her to some deserted place to hide until the danger would pass? He should have been killed rather than submit to such an act. Why did Mordecai not keep righteous Esther from idol worship? Why was he not more careful? Where was his righteousness, his piety, his valor? Esther, too, should have, by right, have tried to commit suicide before allowing herself to have intercourse with Xerxes. Well, the inspired text makes no effort to vindicate Esther by explaining some extenuating circumstance. It makes no effort to report that Esther was operating under some special instruction from God. Now, I've mentioned before that later Greek authors came along and put additions to the book of Esther, uninspired additions to the book of Esther. And when they did that, they would add things. They would add things in Esther's head that the inspired text does not tell us. For example, one of those Greek versions of Esther has Esther announcing at one point that she abhors the bed of the uncircumcised. It cannot be by accident that the original text is silent on that, because anyone reading this text is going to have that question. So if you're going to have that question and the text is silent about that, it's not by accident. It's on purpose. The Holy Spirit, on purpose, did not tell us what was going through Esther's head. The reader is left to decide that. Is Esther wholly righteous? Is she partly righteous or mainly or maybe unrighteous? Or did she start out unrighteous, then experience a big reversal and become... We're just not told. We do have some clues, but the Bible does not explicitly answer that question here or anywhere. You will look in vain for Esther's name on the roll call of faith in Hebrews 11. Same for Mordecai. In fact, you'll look in vain for their name anywhere outside of the book of Esther. The Mordecai that we saw when we studied Ezra is not the same Mordecai we're looking at here. So what is the answer? I think the best answer is likely somewhere in between. We definitely see Esther's righteousness and her courage in this book. But we may also be seeing other things about Esther in this book. And if so, would that be surprising? How many Old Testament characters are presented as wholly righteous, as solely righteous? There are a few, but not many at all. Not many at all. Don't we more often see negative qualities mixed with the positive qualities? And remember, every Jew that we see in the book of Esther is only here in Persia because they had not returned under the decree of Cyrus. So in fact, to many Jews reading the book of Esther, Esther would start off with a negative mark against her, as would Mordecai. Now we know for certain one reason why Esther was doing what she was doing here, such as concealing her identity. We're going to see that in a moment in verse 20. She was obeying Mordecai. She was obeying Mordecai. As for the intercourse with Xerxes, I think that Jewish scholar had at least one thing right, and that is it would have cost Esther her life to have refused. And I believe we can see here that God did not want Esther to pay that price. He had other plans for Esther. The ultimate answer to the question of Esther's character is to see the providence of God at work in the book of Esther, work in her life and in the events that occur in this book. Whether righteous or not, God was able to use Esther to accomplish his plans and his will, and we see God doing that throughout the Bible. We know that Esther will make a very courageous stand in this book. It's coming. But should she have made that courageous stand earlier in the book? Perhaps. But what we know is that when the time for decision finally came, she made the right decision, and we'll see that later. And that's a message for us, that perhaps like Esther, we may be looking back on our own lives with some regret. But this one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind and pressing forward toward the goal, Philippians 3:13. As long as we remain on this earth breathing, it is never too late to do the right thing and have that reversal, that theme of reversal. We can experience that reversal. If you ever find yourself wondering whether it's too late to turn things around, then Esther is the book for you. Because the theme of the book is reversal. As long as you have breath in your body, it's not too late to turn things around. After this 12-month beauty treatment in verse 12, Esther's finally taken before the king in verses 15 through 18. She took with her only what Haggai suggested, I guess trusting him that he knew what would best please the king. The 10th month was a cold, wet month right in the middle of the winter. The seventh year would have been 479 BC. Verse 17 is really the key verse here in these events. King Xerxes made Esther queen in place of Vashti. Esther becomes queen in place of Vashti. We saw what happened to Vashti in the first chapter. This sudden decision, it leaves the reader thinking that Xerxes was just overwhelmed by Esther's beauty, which does seem to be what happened here. And that may also explain why he chose a queen outside of one of the royal families, the leading Persian families, as Herodotus tells us they often did. Although Esther was no doubt beautiful, I do think we see the providence of God at work here as well, through Xerxes. Just as God had worked through Cyrus, as God had worked through Pharaoh, he's working through this earthly ruler to accomplish his will. And that leaves us with a question: how does God's providence work? How does it work? That's a difficult question. We certainly don't have time to take a deep dive into that question. But the best answer to that question comes from the book, from the Bible. If you want to know how God's providence works, you need to look into the Bible to see examples of God's providence, and that will tell you how it works. For example, look and study the life of Joseph. The life of Joseph will tell you so much about the providence of God, as will here the life of Esther and what's happening in her life. I could also recommend a very good book on the subject that's recently been published by Cecil May at Faulkner University, and he's written a book on the subject of providence. It's published by the Gospel Advocate Company. Very good book. Is God providing for his people in the book of Esther with miraculous signs and wonders? No. Is God providing for his people in the book of Esther? Absolutely. Absolutely he is. We see God at work in all of these events, and that's why Esther is such a modern book. It's showing us how God works today, how God has always worked to provide for his people. Miracles have come and they're now gone, but God's providence has never gone. We see it in the garden. We see it in Esther. We see it today. God has always worked to provide for his people. The age of miracles has ended. The age of providence will never end. God will always be providing for his people. The author here avoids the word marriage, although it is implied eventually. Some commentators argue that it was a marriage beyond her control and therefore not a real marriage. Certainly her only other choice at this point would have been death, as we suggested. It's interesting to think now about what's going on here and think about what's going on where we left Ezra. Remember, there's a whole bunch of Jews living in Palestine now. As this is occurring, they're off in Palestine. And we're in a kind of a gap between Ezra 6 and Ezra 7. At this point, what's going on in Esther? Well, we have a Jewish Esther married to a Gentile Xerxes. When we get back to Ezra, what's going to be the most pressing issue that Ezra will be discussing? Intermarriage of Jews with non-Jews. This intermarriage will become a huge issue for Ezra when he shows up. In fact, when we get back to Ezra and we look at Ezra 9 and Ezra 10, that's going to be the point. That's going to be the major point there of those two chapters. And what we're going to find is that Ezra will harshly condemn the mixed marriages, and he will insist that they separate. It really makes someone wonder, how would Ezra have judged this Jewish queen who was now married to a Gentile? What was Esther herself thinking about all this? Had she been swept off her feet by the attention of the most powerful man on earth? Or was she perhaps wondering why God had allowed her to come to such a horrible condition? We're not told what she's thinking. To celebrate, the king gives a great feast. Again, there's one of our themes. We're going to see feasts throughout this book because feasting is a theme of the book of Esther, as is reversal. He also grants a remission of taxes, which no doubt led the people to love Esther as much as the king did. It's interesting to note how often the people of God found themselves in the royal courts. The royal courts. Joseph, Moses, Daniel, and now Esther. As Christians, we should never shy away from opportunities to do likewise. Who knows that we might have been called to a position for a time such as this? For those who don't believe God's people should ever be involved in politics, I'm glad they didn't convince Esther or Joseph or Daniel of that, because look at all the good that they were able to do. Politics needs godly people. Verse 19. And when the virgins were gathered together the second time, then Mordecai sat in the king's gate. Esther had not yet showed her kindred nor her people, as Mordecai had charged her. For Esther did the commandment of Mordecai, like as when she was brought up with him. Well, what does verse 19 mean when it says the virgins were gathered a second time? Well, some think it may have been a flashback to a time before Esther was chosen as queen, before, you know, she was still kind of in the running. But I think the better view is that they're coming back again, kind of being paraded before the king as kind of the unsuccessful contestants, you know. And then Esther, I think, is again being compared with the ones who were not selected to show her great beauty. Mordecai here is sitting in the king's gate. If you remember the handout from last week, that showed the remains of the king's gate that have now been dug up. And you can actually see the spot where Mordecai was sitting. Amazing, fascinating to look at that. That tells us he was an official of some sort. One commentary suggests that maybe after Esther became queen, she promoted Mordecai to this position as magistrate or judge. We don't know if he had it before or had it after. The king's gate, which was shown on that handout, was a building with a gate within it. It was really a building with a gate as part of it. Legal, civil, commercial business was all conducted there. The foundations of that gate were shown on the handout. It measured 130 feet by 90 feet. Had a big central hall that led into a royal compound, had side rooms. It's all been dug up and excavated. And everything they dug up corresponds perfectly with what we're reading here in the book of Esther about how it looked and how it operated. In verse 20, we're again reminded of Mordecai's command to Esther that she not reveal her identity. And here we see that that was a command by Mordecai. So, you know, we asked earlier, why wasn't she revealing her identity? I think the easiest answer is that Mordecai had told her not to do that. But we certainly see no effort here by Esther to get him to change his mind. Later, we're going to see Mordecai telling Esther to reveal her identity, just the opposite command from Mordecai. And that's when Esther's finally going to stand up and say, whoa, stop the horses here. I don't want to reveal my identity. In fact, the only time in the entire book when Esther raises any protest to Mordecai is found later in chapter 4, where Esther protests not Mordecai's instruction to keep her heritage hidden, but his instruction to reveal it before the king. After those events, it's interesting to look at the relation between Mordecai and Esther. What's going on right here? Mordecai is commanding Esther, and Esther's doing it. Toward the end of this book, Esther will be commanding Mordecai, and Mordecai will be doing it. And what is that? A reversal. A reversal. Verse 21. In those days, while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains, Bigthan and Teresh, of those which kept the door, were wroth and sought to lay hand on the king Ahasuerus. And the thing was known to Mordecai, who told it unto Esther the queen. And Esther certified the king thereof in Mordecai's name. And when inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out. Therefore they were both hanged on a tree, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles before the king. Well, first question, why did these two chamberlains, better translation, eunuchs, why did these two eunuchs become angry? Well, we're not told, but remember that something had happened between chapter 1 and where we are now. What had happened is that Xerxes had gone off to Greece to try to take over the Greeks, and he'd come back humiliated, defeated, his treasury depleted. That had happened in between. So perhaps these eunuchs were angry about that, and that perhaps had caused this. Later, we know from extra-biblical history that Xerxes would be assassinated under very similar circumstances. So that may be what's going on here, that may be an early plot. Later, it was successful. Well, Mordecai hears of the plot, and he tells Esther about it, who then tells the king. The conspirators are hanged on a tree, which likely meant their death by impalement. And then the events are recorded in the book of Chronicles before the king. Herodotus tells us about that same book. Herodotus says, whenever Xerxes saw one of his officers behaving with distinction, he would find out his name, and his secretaries wrote it down together with his city and his parentage. So in fact, Herodotus tells us that he did have a book like this, and Esther is telling us about it as well. And now we know that Mordecai's name is going to be written in this book. Verse 22 tells us something very important about Esther. I mentioned earlier today that, well, we don't know if she's righteous or unrighteous, etc. Here we see Esther doing something very good, which, you know, may give a good answer to the type of person Esther is. Esther gave credit where credit was due. And if she had not done so, these events would have turned out very differently, wouldn't they? And there's a very important lesson there for us. In fact, there are several lessons there for us. The first lesson, of course, is the surface lesson, and that is we should give credit where credit is due. We should not take unearned honors upon ourselves. Esther did not do that. She gave credit to Mordecai, and later that would turn out to be a very important thing, how the events would turn out. But there's a second, I think, deeper lesson for us here. Our seemingly small to us anyway, acts of integrity can have huge, unforeseen impacts on the lives of others and on our own lives. And in fact, the same could be said about our seemingly small to us anyway, acts of disobedience can have huge, unforeseen impacts on ourselves and on others. There was a commercial running recently, you probably saw it, where some person would do a good deed, like open a door for someone, and someone would see that, and then they'd do a good deed, and then them would see that, and they'd do a good deed. It kind of spread around. I forget what it was advertising. I hope it wasn't beer. I don't remember what it was. But whatever it was, you remember the commercial. We're not living in a vacuum. People see what we do. They see how we live. They hear how we talk. They see our priorities, our actions, our words. They see what we do. Everything we do, whether good or bad, creates a ripple. And we need to be sure we're creating good ripples, because we don't know where those ripples are leading. We don't know how long those ripples will last. This ripple from Esther, where she just said, you know, Mordecai really did that. I could take total credit and just make the king think I did. No, I'll give credit to Mordecai. That ripple is still going today. We cannot see the results of those ripples. We cannot see where they're going to lead. God can, but we cannot. We cannot. I was trying to think of a good analogy for that, and the best one I could come up with is that God plays a perfect game of chess. When we make a move, God can see all of the resulting moves all the way to the end of the game. But, you know, when I make a chess move, I'm lucky if I can see one or two moves ahead. Not with God. God plays the perfect game. He can see every single move, everything that can happen, all the way to the end of the game. And perhaps rather than saying God is the perfect chess player, a better analogy would be to say God is the perfect chess coach. Because God is not playing chess with us. God is telling us how to play the chess game. And He's instructing us which moves to make through His Word. And are we going to trust ourselves where we can only see a few moves ahead? Or are we going to trust God who can see all the way to the end? You may have heard of the butterfly effect. That's the idea that very small things can cause very large things to occur. The idea being that a butterfly flapping its wings on one side of the world, that little perturbation of the wind can somehow turn into a hurricane all the way around the other side of the world. It's called the butterfly effect. The problem is that we can't tell which events in our own lives might experience the butterfly effect. Most of them look very small to us at the time, perhaps like the flapping of a butterfly's wings, but some of those decisions, either for obedience or disobedience, could have huge, huge impacts later on in our lives or in the lives of others. This small decision by Esther in verse 22 is an example of that, because it will eventually lead to the salvation of the Jewish people from Haman. That's where this will eventually lead. Questions about chapter 2. Chapter 3, verse 1. After these things did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him, and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. Well, the villain finally takes the stage in chapter 3 with Haman. One of the attorneys I work with is Jewish, and I asked him about the Feast of Purim. first thing I asked him was, how do you pronounce it, Purim or Purim? He said, it's Purim. So that then led me to tell him, you know, I'm teaching a class on Esther, and I asked him about the Feast of Purim. And he said that when that, it's still celebrated, and that when it's celebrated, they will read the book of Esther, and that all the children are given noisemakers, and that every time the name of Haman is read out, they all hit those noisemakers, trying to drown out the name of Haman. And it's funny, he said, because they'll know it's coming. You know, they know it, and so they're listening, and they know it's just about to hit. Then they'll all hit their noisemakers and drown out the speaker. I'm not recommending that this morning, but that's how it's celebrated. And the reason, of course, they're drowning him out is that Haman is one of the horrible enemies of the Jewish people in history. He was trying to be equal with another great enemy of the Jews, whose name also started with an H, of our own time. We're not told why Haman was honored in this way by the king, but it's interesting how the text operates here, because the inspired text shows us the promotion of Haman at the very time we would have expected to see the promotion of Mordecai. But we don't see the promotion of Mordecai. Instead, we see the promotion of Haman. You know, you would have thought Mordecai would have gotten this. He'd foiled the plot to kill the king. No, it's Haman. Haman. And as far as we know, Mordecai goes unrewarded. Mordecai saves the king, and Haman is promoted. In a moment, we're going to be asking a similar question to Mordecai that we ask about Esther, and that is, what's going through Mordecai's head? Well, keep that in mind, that Mordecai may have been a little resentful about Haman. Now, when Haman is introduced, he's identified as an Agagite, which is perhaps one of the most important words in the entire book of Esther, Agagite. The reference to Haman's nationality hints at a conflict that at this time was already centuries old. Now, of course, in terms of Middle East conflicts, that's just yesterday, right? Because right today, they're fighting conflicts that are millennia old. Agag was the king of the Amalekites at the time that Saul was the first king of Israel. And you'll recall that Mordecai and Saul were both from the tribe of Benjamin, both descended from someone named Kish. And in fact, when Mordecai was first introduced, the text made sure that the reader understood that Mordecai was connected to King Saul. And now we see an Agagite, who of course was also connected to King Saul, Agag, the king of the Amalekites. The Amalekites had a very dubious distinction. They were the first nation to try to attack and destroy God's people when they entered the land. In response, God promised Moses that he would completely destroy the Amalekites and that he would be at war with them from generation to generation, Exodus 17:8 through 16. Balaam's oracle in Numbers 24:7 predicted that the Israelite king would be greater than Agag, the Amalekite king. Later, God instructed King Saul to attack the Amalekites and totally destroy everything that belonged to them, 1 Samuel 15. Saul attacked them, but he spared the life of King Agag, and he kept the best of the sheep and the best of the cattle in disobedience to God's command. Samuel shows up, he curses Saul, and then he cuts Agag into pieces. Saul was later killed by an Amalekite, 2 Samuel 1, 1-16. So that's the history. That all comes into a Jewish mind with just the word Agagite. You say that word, and they're immediately thinking about all of that, and it all comes to their mind. And now they understand. Now they know why it was so important that we understand Mordecai was connected to Saul. Why is that so important? Because Haman is an Agagite, and they're putting that all together. That's why it's important. God's promise to be at war with the Amalekites through generation was given to Moses in the context of the Sinai covenant, the first covenant, the covenant that had been disobeyed, the covenant that the disobedience of which had caused them to be set into exile. That's why they're here, because they disobeyed that covenant. Could they expect God to remain faithful to those promises now that they had not been faithful to their side of the covenant? Those are the questions that are posed by the simple identification of Haman as an Agagite. And you wonder where God is in the book of Esther. He's not mentioned by name. But anybody reading this book and seeing Agagite and seeing Kish and seeing Benjamite, the tribe of Benjamin, they're going to be thinking of God and what he had done and what he commanded about the Amalekites. Verses 2 through 4. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. Then the king's servants, which were in the king's gate, said unto Mordecai, Why transgressest thou the king's commandment? Now it came to pass, when they spoke daily unto him, and he hearkened not unto them, that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's matter would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. In the first chapter of Esther, we saw an example of respect commanded and respect refused. And here we're seeing an example of respect commanded and again respect refused. Why did Mordecai refuse to honor Haman? Well, some have suggested that Mordecai resented Haman's promotion and his own lack of reward. We talked about that a moment ago. And in fact, in the Greek version of Esther, which I've mentioned, where they add a bunch of stuff that's not inspired, they say Mordecai refused to bow down because he said, I will not give glory that's due to God to any man. But you know, it's known from other sources that Jews did bow down to pagan officials of the Persian court. Why? Because it was not seen as a religious act. It was seen rather as court protocol, as paying respects to them. Herodotus confirms that Persians regularly bowed down to themselves, to higher ranking officials. In fact, Mordecai, along with everybody else, would have bowed down to King Xerxes, or they would have had their head removed. No one in Persia ever refused to bow down to King Xerxes and kept breathing. Is it wrong to bow down to anybody? Well, in Genesis 33, verse 3, Jacob bowed down to the ground 7 times as he approached his brother Esau. In 1 Samuel 24, 8, David bowed down and prostrated himself to the ground before King Saul. The Greek historians report that Persians greeted themselves with social, if they were of equal rank, they would give themselves each a kiss. If they were a slightly different status, it would be a kiss on the cheek rather than a kiss on the mouth. And if there was a great status difference, they would have be completely prostrate on the ground. They would bow down. That's how the Persians approached each other. Did Mordecai refuse to bow down to Haman out of pride? Was he upset that Haman had been honored instead of himself after he was the one who saved the king's life? History tells us that those honored by the king would usually get promotions. Mordecai didn't seem to get that. They'd get a tax exemption. That's not mentioned. And they would also sometimes get an exemption from having to bow down to people. Maybe Mordecai was just taking that honor upon himself as his due. History tells us that the honor bestowed upon Haman back in verse 1, that meant he became the prime minister or the top official of King Xerxes. That person would have been called the king's eye because he was responsible for reporting threats on the king's life. Again, Mordecai would think, why didn't I get that position? Because I just did that. I just did that and saved the king's life, and now he's made Haman the king's eye. Did Mordecai believe he deserved that honor that Haman had received? In fact, later we're going to see that Mordecai is the natural successor to Haman after Haman is killed. Or perhaps Mordecai could see what sort of person Haman was. And maybe Haman was going to be another threat to the king. And maybe Mordecai was again trying to protect King Xerxes. We're just not told this. But I think the correct answer is the one that's supported here best by the text. It's also supported by Jewish tradition. And that is that no self-respecting Benjamite would ever bow down to an Amalekite. Ever. It could have been due to religious scruples, like we said, of not bowing down to anybody. But again, the Persian king didn't command that he be worshipped, as we saw with some other false kings. That wasn't the way the Persians operated. I think the best explanation is the one that has to do with their ancestry. That also explains why Haman's ancestry is told us, why we're also told about Mordecai's ancestry. And of course, we're going to see what we just saw is that Mordecai's answer to them is that I'm a Jew. That's the answer he gives. I think it also best explains Haman's reaction to the slight. Mordecai has disrespected me, therefore I will kill Mordecai? No. Therefore I will kill all the Jews. Again, it points to a racial conflict. Whatever caused Mordecai to refuse, the Bible does not tell us explicitly, and it was also not obvious to his colleagues because they asked him repeatedly, why are you doing this? This is crazy. Why are you not bowing down to Haman? And the final phrase in verse 4, he had told them he was a Jew. I think that, again, drives home the point. This has to do with the ancient animosity between the Amalekites and the Jews. Some might say, well, no, that just meant he's a Jew and I have to obey the Jewish law. But no, I think it's pointing to the animosity between the two. Finally, they, being the so-called friends of Mordecai, go and tell Haman what's going on. Would Haman have found out otherwise? Well, perhaps not. Maybe Mordecai was standing in the background and not making an open show of things. Haman had not apparently noticed this on his own yet. He had to be told about it. Perhaps Haman would never have noticed had it not been pointed out to him. So those three little words in verse 4, they told Haman, maybe they're the most important words in the text. Aren't they the words that incite the conflict that almost lead to the destruction of God's people? And what does the verse tell us? Blessed are the troublemakers. No. Blessed are the peacemakers. As for troublemakers, God hates them. Proverbs 6, 16 through 19. And in fact, if you look at those things that God hates in Proverbs 6, 16 through 19, you ought to keep those in mind as you look through the book of Esther, as you read the book, because Haman will be guilty of each and every one of them. In fact, we may see a few of them and some other people in the book of Esther. For example, is Mordecai himself completely in the clear on this? I would suggest no. If the only reason Mordecai refused to obey the king's command was because of something that had happened centuries earlier between Saul and Agag. We see that same kind of hatred today in the Middle East, and we're still suffering today because of that hatred, that same kind of hatred. If Mordecai refused to bow down because of his fidelity to the law, then that's one thing. That would have been the right decision. And maybe that's what was going on. But as we discussed, I don't think that's what was going on. I think he was bowing down because of this ancient animosity. And if that's what was going on, then I think that was most likely the wrong thing to be doing. I say most likely because of a verse in Deuteronomy that I'll get to in a moment, but I think that was most likely the wrong thing to be doing. Yes, Haman was evil, but so was Nero. And 1 Peter 2:17 commanded that Nero be honored. Why do we obey civil authorities when their commands do not conflict with God's authority? We obey them because in that situation they are acting as a minister of God. Romans 13, 1 through 7. Had Mordecai given Haman the honor he was due and given King Xerxes the honor he was due because it was Xerxes' command that Mordecai was disobeying, then much of the trouble that followed might have been avoided. I say might have been, because Haman may have been looking for any excuse to attack God's people. And if this one didn't work out, he probably would have found another one. Mordecai was not the only person here with racial animosity. Haman certainly had it as well. I said perhaps earlier about following the law, and the reason for that is Deuteronomy 25, 19. Therefore it shall be when the Lord thy God hath given thee rest from all thine enemies round about, and the land thy Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance to possess it, that thou shalt blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven, thou shalt not forget it. So maybe Mordecai believed he was best following that commandment by refusing to bow down. We're not told. Mordecai does tell the other servants here that he's a Jew. Mordecai identifies with God's people. Esther has not yet done that. Mordecai does that. That can always cause hardship. It can always cause persecution. Mordecai had now made that identification in verse 4, and you're going to see what follows from that. And we should not fail to make that identification. God does not need any secret agents. He needs soldiers who are wearing his armor. Esther had not yet done that, but soon she will have the opportunity to do so. Verse 5. And when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence, then was Haman full of wrath. And he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had showed him the people of Mordecai. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai. Haman's pride, Haman's hunger for power, they caused him to be filled with fury at Mordecai's refusal to honor him. Notice the difference here in how the text presents Mordecai and Esther and Haman. We're not left to wonder about what's going through Haman's head. We are about Mordecai. We are about Esther. But Haman's head is peeled open and we're allowed to look inside. We know what he's thinking. We know why he's doing what he's doing. Haman is allowed no mysteries here. We know exactly what's going through Haman's head. Here's how one commentary described Haman. Haman is devoured by his obsession with control. Such an obsession is a single, eradicable notion that dominates the thoughts and feelings in spite of one's own will. Mordecai's refusal to show fear, indeed his very presence in the king's gate, proves to Haman that whatever his might, he lacks control. He cannot govern the Jews' emotions. He cannot even prevent his current presence in the place of power. But ironically and appropriately, Haman's obsession with control, in effect, imposes Mordecai's presence upon all of his thoughts and gives Mordecai power over his mind, robbing him of all the pleasure he might derive from the honor, wealth, and power in which he glories. Haman makes himself miserable. And don't we see that here in Haman? Rather than attack Mordecai alone, which may have also been because Mordecai was an official of the king, he decides just to wipe out Mordecai's entire race. Whatever else we say about Esther and Mordecai, Mordecai's Jewishness was known, Esther's was not. That also explains, I think, why they're talking between intermediaries. And that's because Mordecai's relation to Esther must have still been secret. Otherwise, Haman would have known that Esther was also Jewish. That Esther's Jewish ancestry was not known may tell us something about how she had been living. As one commentary noted, for the masquerade to last this long, Esther must have been doing more than just eating like a Persian and dressing like a Persian and living like a Persian. She must have been worshiping like a Persian. But before we become too judgmental of Esther, maybe we should turn that around on ourselves. Are we hiding our true identity from the world by how we eat and how we dress and how we live and how we worship? Are we doing those things like the Persians around us? Are we hiding our true identity? Do our co-workers think we're a Persian just like they are? Incredibly, some commentaries argue that Haman's attempted genocide of the entire Jewish race is so improbable that the entire story must be fictitious. Now let that sink in for a moment. It's because of arguments like that that professors get the reputation for living in isolated ivory towers, completely unaware of the world that's around them. How could anybody living in today's world ever argue that attempted genocide is too improbable to happen when they see it all around them? Even in Haman's day, it was not too incredible to occur. When Smerdis the Magus was killed, every Persian in the capital took up weapons against that ethnic group. It had already happened, history tells us. And perhaps we should pause for a moment and just say a few words about anti-Semitism, of which this attempted genocide is just one of many examples extending all the way up to the present day. The sad fact is that anti-Semitism has often been linked with Christianity. And that is something we must never condone. Let me give you this quote by a famous German. You tell me who said it. Famous German. First, to set fire to their synagogues or schools and to bury and cover with dirt whatever won't burn. Second, I advise that their houses be razed and destroyed. Third, I advise that all their prayer books be taken from them. Fourth, I advise that their rabbis be forbidden to teach henceforth on pain of loss of life and limb. Fifth, I advise that safe conduct on the highways be abolished completely for the Jews. Who said that? Was it Hitler? Was it part of the Nuremberg Code? No, it was Martin Luther said that. Samuel Sandmel has written that the organized massacres in Eastern Europe of the Jews from which his parents fled, he said they always started with the same thing, the ringing of church bells. And he said, I remember as an American boy how my mother used to shiver whenever the bells rang in the church near our home. How sad. We know what our attitude should be toward the Jewish race or toward any race. As far as the Church of Christ is concerned, there are two groups of people in the world, those in Christ and those out of Christ. There is no Greek or Jew, circumcised or uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave, free, but Christ is all and in all, Colossians 3:11. And that should be our attitude. I've mentioned that Esther is a very modern book, and one reason is that Esther is a textbook on racial hatred and all the evils that it can cause. At the heart of these events is racial hatred between Haman and Mordecai. And that hatred, it seems, ran both ways. We'll start there next week. Thank you very much for your attention.